Yeah, Shikoa, thank you, Phil. Thank you for the plug. An uncle of mine is a president of his temple, and he was on the rabbi search committee. And he told me that when he was on the committee, he always used to ask potential candidates who were going to be a rabbi, he always used to ask them, "Let me ask you something, do you lie?" And he told me they always used to squirm and that, you know, because no matter what they said, you know, they're in trouble. If they said, "Well, I lie," then you're in trouble. And if they said, "I don't lie," then he's lying. So, you know, what do you do? So we're going to talk about the Torah perspective on lying, telling the truth. When do you always have to tell the truth? And we're going to see that there's cases when you don't have to tell the truth. But like any mitzvah in the Torah, what the Torah asks of us is that we really analyze it. We don't just take it as a, you know, a nice overarching, you know, idea, but it has specifics. There are details in it, and that's how we learn. That's how we learn Torah. We don't just say, for example, you know, honor their parents. You know, the Gemara goes into, okay, who has to pay for it? You know, we get very specific with our mitzvos, and similarly with lying. If we really go through the sugya, you know, I think if we were all rabbis coming to that, you know, facing that question on the as a rabbi candidate, we'd probably be better prepared if we knew what the Torah says and what the Gemaras say and what the precedents are for it. So in the Torah, we know that we read actually in today's Parsha, it's no coincidence, I'm sure, that in today's Parsha that we read today, it says Midvar Sheker Tirchak, that you're supposed to distance yourself from a lie, which is very interesting because this, as the Sefer Echinuch points out, this is the only mitzvah in the Torah where it says not only not to do it, but you have to distance yourself from it. Right? It's a very, very severe thing. Why? Why is it so? Why is this the only? Why is this so exceptional that it phrases it in this way? So I'll read you what the Sefer Echinuch writes. It says, "Shoresh haMitzvah Yadua Ki Hashekar Nitav VeNelach BeEinei HaKol." That lies, falsehood is disgusting in everyone's eyes. It's the most repulsive thing. That anyone who loves lies and is involved in a life of lies, of falsehood, that there's always curses and bad things going on in such a house. You know, our greatest rabbis, they've always made it a point to really distance themselves to an extreme almost of sheker. I know Rav Pam, he was raised in a house where his mother never used to even say the word sheker. She used to say, if she had a complaint against him, she would say, you know, if she was, you know, upset about someone not being honest, she would say, "That's not emes. That's not." She would never say the word sheker. That sensitivity is what, you know, is what can be mechanech or gedolim to reach such heights. There's a story with Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky when he was a yeshiva bacher in Europe. So the way they used to, you know, house the people, they used to have them eat by different houses in the town, and not always were all the houses up to, you know, the standards of these yeshiva bachers, especially when it came time for Pesach. And Pesach was a time, and there's all these different stringencies that you have on Pesach. So there are some families that you know, were not completely trustworthy in their kashrus. So one time it happened that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was invited over one of these houses who he wasn't so sure about their kashrus, and he said to them, "I can't come." So they said, well, they pressed him, "Why can't you come?" He says, "Well, I keep gebrukst, and I know that you don't keep gebrukst. Gebrukst is when you don't mix and put any liquids on your matzah, and really, for those of you who ever experienced it, it really affects, like, it's not just matzah and liquids, but it's kind of, it runs throughout your whole menu on Pesach." So he says, I don't eat gebrukst. Now, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was a real litvak. He wasn't chassidish at all. And he certainly never kept gebrukst. But he told them, you know, for the sake of peace, that, you know what, I keep gebrukst. Now, as we're going to see later on, he probably could have just said that and then continued, you know, his non-gebrukst ways and been just fine. But Rav Yaakov, he was so sensitive to this midah of emes that for the rest of his life, he always kept gebrukst after that. Which is an amazing thing because I've experienced gebrukst myself. I was in a house for a number of years that kept gebruchst, and it's not an easy thing. So to change all of a sudden from non-gebruchst to gebruchst, especially for your whole life, it's a really big deal. But the point is that our gedolim, that sensitivity of our gedolim that they've had towards emes is really something that we could all learn from. So when we talk about honesty and levels of honesty, levels of lies, like if they say that Eskimos have 24 different words for snow, because if you're in the North Pole, to us it's just like snow. There's powdery snow, maybe slushy snow. But to Eskimos, that they deal with that their whole life. So there's 24 different words for snow in the Eskimo language, apparently, reportedly. So we have, by the same token, we Jews, we're very into emes, very into truth. And Rabbeinu Yonah counts for us, there are actually nine different categories of falsehood. And he lists them from the most severe to the most lenient. Very interesting way of putting it down. It's really the first one to actually make these degrees of telling a lie. But let's just go through them a little bit, just very quickly, to go over them and to just give us a sensitivity to, you know, what degrees of lying there are that exist out there, and to which ones we have to be careful about, and to what degree and to what extent. So number one, a falsehood that causes a direct loss to others, right? If you tell someone, what do you mean, I paid you, and you actually didn't pay him, right? That would be an example of causing a direct loss. A falsehood that causes an indirect loss to others is maybe if you tell someone else that go to him, you can buy something else over there, when it's really not true, you're causing an indirect loss. The third category is a falsehood that causes a loss of expected profit. In other words, the person could have made a profit off of you. He didn't actually lose money because of you lying to him, but now he's unable to make a profit. The fourth category, a deliberate inconsequential falsehood. In other words, you're just talking around, you make up a story. You're schmoozing among friends, and you said, oh, you know, the following happened to me. It never happened to you, but you want to make a nice story up. That's the fourth level of telling a lie. Number five, and it gets more subtle as we go along. Offering a favor with no intent to fulfill it, right? You tell someone you're going to do something for them. You don't make good on it, right? That's the fifth level. The sixth level is a little bit easier than that. Backing out of a promise to do a favor. In other words, at the time you made the promise, you told someone, I'm going to do something for you, and then something came up, you weren't able to keep it. So at the time you made the promise, you actually intended to keep the promise, but then afterwards something happens, you back out of it. Now on this, by the way, it's a very interesting point. The Gemara deals with a very interesting case where there's actually sometimes when you can back out of a promise. And like I said in the beginning, it's very important to know exactly the criteria. When exactly do I have to stick to my word? And when is there room for leniency? And if we know the room for leniency, very often, once we know what the rules are specifically, it helps us to actually keep the rules themselves. In other words, if it's just vague, if we're just like, you know, we have this vague idea of that you always have to be truthful, we don't know exactly where it lines up and exactly to what extent it goes. You know, it's very difficult to be completely truthful. But if you know the exact guidelines and exact parameters, it makes it much easier. So there's Gemara in Bab Metzia, Mem Tes Amud Aleph, which says the following. It says, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Ha'omer lechaveiro matana ani nosen lach, yochal lach sabo. If you say to your friend, I'm going to give you a present. Right? You say to someone, I'm going to, you know, buy you a new car. You say to your kid, I'm going to buy you a new car. So you're allowed to go back on that promise. So it says, Yachol, Pshita, he can, meaning the Gemara thinks that he's not going to be taken to court if he does that. So Yachol says the Gemara, Pshita, of course he's not going to be taken to court if he goes back on that promise. Ella says the Gemara, no, Mutter Lachserbo. He's allowed to, Lechatchila, he's allowed to go back on it. Amar of Papa, Umode Rabbi Yochanan b'matanamu etes, desamcha detayhu. So at this point in the Gemara we think that, oh, you're allowed to just renege on a promise. Right? It seems to be what Rabbi Yochanan is saying. So Rav Papa comes along and he qualifies that. Amar of Papa, Umode Rabbi Yochanan b'matanamu etes, desamcha detayhu. That Rabbi Yochanan will agree that in the case of a small promise, if you promise someone something small, you know, you're not promising I'm going to buy you a new car. You're saying, hey, I'll give you a ride somewhere. That you have to honor. That you can't back out of. Right? But what comes out of this Gemara is that, and the underlying principle, as Rashi spells out over here, is that anytime somebody is relying on you for something, you have to come through with it. You have to keep that promise. However, and this is an important exception to know, that if you make a kind of a vague, a broad promise, what's called in halacha a matana maruba, you make a grand promise which you didn't make any sort of formal kinyan on, or you didn't do a handshake or any sort of act, okay? On that promise, there actually is room to renege on it if something, some circumstances change later on. Very interesting thing, and this is one of the exceptions that, and we're going to get more into the exceptions very soon, about when it's okay to kind of go back on your word. Okay, so that's case number one. And the post can bring down a few different ideas about this, and certain times when you're actually allowed to renege on a promise. Okay, so you have to meet the following criteria. In order to renege on a promise, it has to be that it has to be either a large, you know, promise that wasn't really substantiated, or if it was done in public, you can't go back on that, because that's the, and or also if so in those two cases, right, what's the common link? The common link is that the person who you're telling it to, the person who's relying on you, is actually relying on you. And the bottom line is, anytime it's samcha daitayhu, you have this aspect that somebody is relying on you to do something, you have to keep your word. But in a case where, you know, maybe he's not totally relying on you, or it's, you know, it's the normal way of people to, you know, maybe exaggerate a little bit, he's not necessarily counting on you, there's actually room to be makel in such a case. Okay? Now, the last three categories, number 7 through 9, are actually very subtle, and these probably are the more common cases of what we get into when we talk about being honest and honesty as it comes up with in everyday life. Okay? Number 7 is the concept of pretending to do a favor for someone, making them think that you like them more than you actually do. This is the concept known as Genevas Das. Okay? And the Gemara in Chulin, on Chulin Tzadi Dalet, it has a whole sugya about the concept of Genevas Das, when you're allowed to, or the fact that you're not allowed to fool someone into thinking that they like you more than it actually implies. And the cases are as follows. Rabbi Meir Omer, the Brisa says as follows. Rabbi Meir used to teach, Al yisar hev adam lechaver lisod etzlo. You should not invite someone to eat with you, to dine with you. V'yodea bo she'eno soed. And you know he can't make it that night, right? This comes up sometimes. You have a wedding, you know, and out of town. I got married in L.A., so I know what it's like. You know, you can invite a few more people than you normally would, because you know not everyone's going to show up. It's not like you're going to have to pay for that many people. So you can invite actually a few more people because you know they're not going to show up anyway. So the Gemara in Chulin tells us you're not allowed to do that, because what are you doing? You're giving someone the impression that, yeah, I want you at my wedding, when in truth, you know, if it was an in-town wedding, you wouldn't invite him. Right? You're making him think that you like him a little bit more than you actually do. So again, you're not causing any financial loss. You're not even directly lying. But nonetheless, the Gemara says that is an example of Genevas Das. You can't do that. As a campus rabbi, I work a lot through texts, to text my students, you know, to come to certain events. So everyone knows there's what's called a mass text, where you just, you know, you write, hey, are you coming tonight? And you could send that same message to, you know, 20 people at the same time, and they all get it. And if you personalize it, you know, that carries a little more weight. You know, are you coming to my class tonight, Dave? Well, that's going to, you know, carry a little bit more weight when Dave gets that text message, because it's actually personalized. So what about the following case? Let's say I have 5 Daves on my email list, on my text message list. Am I allowed to text, hey, Dave, are you coming to my class tonight? You know, because I'm doing it to 5 Daves. It's making it seem personal when in fact it might not be personal. So I don't know the exact answer. Maybe ask a rabbi. But that gets into the whole sugya of what's called Genevas Das. You're making somebody think that you like them or you're more friendly with them than you actually are. So that's the 7th category of sheker. That's what's called Genevas Das. 8th category, even more subtle, right? Accepting praise when you don't actually deserve it, right? So let's say, for example, someone says, oh, you know, I heard you know all of Shas, and really you only know half a shas, or you only know one Mishnah, so you have to correct them. So that's an example where you're not even doing anything. You didn't even say anything. But nonetheless, there's an obligation on you to, if you want to be completely honest, you have an obligation to correct the person. You have to set him straight. Say, no, I don't know all of shas, I'm sorry. So I remember there was once a time, a few years ago, where there was no Bal Kori in Shul. The Bal Kori didn't show up. It was Chol HaMoed Pesach. And I happened to know the leaning of that day. So this is, anyone who's ever read the Torah, this is like your dream. You know the leaning, and nobody is there to read the Torah. And you're like the hero. You come in and you say, oh, I can read the Torah, no problem. And so someone, I leaned the Torah, and everyone's like, wow, oh, you're Bal Kori? So I had to say, well, no, I actually just happened to know that one, right? But if I would have just said, yeah, sure, I know the whole Torah, right? That would have been Gnevas Das. Even if I didn't correct him, even if they would have just said, oh, wow, that's amazing that you're a Bal Kori, even if they didn't ask for a response, I would have had an obligation to correct them. Because just, standing silently while they're heaping praise on me, well, that's not appropriate. That's in a way, it's a form of not telling the truth. And the ninth category we have is just a convenient, inconsequential lie. Let's say, someone asks you, when did you go to bed last night? And say, well, I went to sleep at 10, really went to sleep at 11. Something like that, where you're not really, you're just kind of stretching the truth a little bit. It's not going to affect anyone. Nonetheless, it's lying. Okay, so these nine categories, I think what it does to when we analyze it, we can break it down to see, what are the different ways that you can actually violate the commandment of Midvar Sheker Tirchak. When you analyze it and you go through each of these categories, it really sensitizes you to, how honest you could actually be, to the extent of the truth that you could actually be. There's a friend of mine who's in business I respect him so much because he's one of the most honest people I know. He always says that if there's more than one way to understand it, you're not being truthful. Which is, I think that's a tremendous degree of being honest. That if there's even two ways to understand something, that's not emes. He says, to me, in my line of work, I have to make sure that when I say something, there's no other way to understand it, and it's completely clear. Otherwise, I'm not doing my job. So I think that's a level, and when you understand that, you appreciate all these different categories. You see how you can analyze it and slice it up into all these different levels of MS. It really gives you a perspective and really sensitizes us to how honest we really should be. Now, I mentioned briefly that there is the one exception about backing out of a promise. There's actually a few other times that it's not only permissible to lie, it's actually a good thing to lie. Okay? The most famous example is the Gemara that you have in Ksubos. Gemara says that we all go to chasanas and we know the famous song, Ketzad Tana Rabbanan, San Ksuvas Yidzayin, Tana Rabbanan, Ketzad Meraktim Lufnei Kala. How do you dance in front of the Kala? Now, it doesn't mean just dancing. It means how do you make the chasan and Kala feel good? Okay? How do you make them feel good? What do you do? Beishami says, Kala Kamoshihi, the bride as she is. Right? Meaning if she's a beautiful bride, you say, hey, you talk to the husband, you say, you have a wonderful, beautiful bride. And if the bride is not so beautiful, so you praise her for something else. She has a wonderful midos, something like that. But you don't say that she's beautiful. You can't lie. Beis Hillel says, Kala na'ava chasud, a very famous line. She is a kala na'ava chasud. She is a beautiful and delightful kala. No matter what she looks like, she is beautiful. You're allowed to lie in that situation, according to Beis Hillel. And what follows is a very interesting dialogue between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Amru lehen Beis Shammai le Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai said to Beis Hillel, Haresha haisach higeres asuma, if she was lame or blind, Amru lo kala nava chasid, you say a beautiful and delightful kala? That's vahatora amru midvar sheker tirchak. What about the Torah? The Torah tells us you have to distance yourself from lies. How can you praise a kala who is not beautiful, so how can you say that she is beautiful? Isn't that lying? So what do you think Beis Hillel's answer is going to be? If you were Beis Hillel, how would you answer? Isn't it lying? Okay. Every is college. Okay.
This night is special for her, and you want to make her feel beautiful.
Okay. So it's okay to lie. So let's see. So Amar Lehem Beis Hillel Beis Shammai. So Beis Hillel doesn't really answer the question. Look very carefully what he says. According to you, Beis Shammai, Misha Lakach Mekach Ram and Ashak. Let's say a person bought something that, you know, a guy buys a car and you know it's a lemon, right? Yishabchenu Be'enovo Yiganenu Be'enovo. And should you praise it or should you degrade it? Of course, you should praise it. Therefore, so too over here, you should say that this kala is a beautiful kala. Very interesting Gemara. And truth be told, the Mefarshim asked this question. They said, wait a minute, Beis Hillel, you didn't answer the question. You just answered the question with another similar case. But you don't explain the underlying idea about what permits you to go against the Torah's prohibition against lying. Beis Hillel never really explains himself. So what is the underlying idea of Beis Hillel? So the Marsha gives one answer, which we will not get into here. But there is another answer said by other Mefarshim, other Poskim, which is based on a Gemara, which is based on an episode in the Chumash. Very interesting episode between Sarah and Abraham. And when the angels came to visit Sarah to tell her the good news that she's going to have a child. So I'm going to ask everyone to take 2 minutes to look over this. It's source 8 in the source sheet over here. The dialogue between when the angels come in and tell Abraham and Sarah the good news that they're going to have a child. And we know that Sarah laughs. Okay, and there are two lies or two non-truths that go on in this episode. One of them is very obvious. And one of them is very subtle. So I want to throw it out here to the audience now and ask you to try to come up with what are the two lies in this episode. Excellent. Excellent. Right? So the first lie, let's just start with the easy lie. The first lie is very obvious. Sarah said, I didn't laugh, and when of course she actually did. So that was wrong, and that's pretty clear in the Chumash, how when she denied the fact that she laughed, that was a blatant lie, that was wrong. But there's a second lie going on here, right, that went on. And who said that lie? Who was the author of that lie?
Hashem.
Right? Hashem actually changes the truth in this case. What is the case? Right? Because when Sarah reacts, right, in Pasuk Yud Beis, she says, Vatitzchak Sarah Bekir Balimer. When she hears the good news, she laughs to herself and she says, Acharei Belosi Haisa Li Edna, after I'm withered, I'm gonna have youth. Vaduniza Kain, my husband is old. How am I going to have a child when my husband is old? That's what she says to herself when she laughs. Okay? And yet when you find that Hashem comes to Avraham, Hashem comes to Avraham in the next Pasuk Yigimel, Vayomer Hashem al Avraham, Lama zet tzachaka Sarah lemor? Why did Sarah laugh saying, Ha'af umnam eled va'ani zakanti? That how am I going to have a child when I am old? Right? Well, now, when Hashem reports it back to Abraham, who does he say is old?
Just Sarah.
Who does Hashem say is old? Hashem says that Sarah laughed because she thought she was old.
Yes.
Right? He doesn't say a word about Abraham being old. Right? So you see that Hashem himself changes the truth in this instance. Yes?
If Hashem is changing the truth, he's not only embarrassed Abraham. And he doesn't want to cause pain to others. And go back to what you said about a friend buys a lemon. You know it's a lemon. You don't say anything to your friend. Oh, wait, never mind. Okay, I got it.
You don't say it, right. That supports it, right?
So what did she say? My wife says the first lie. Repeat that again.
wife said it was the first lie.
The first lie, Sarah denies the fact that she actually left when in fact she did laugh. That's the obvious lie. That's the obvious lie. But in over here in Pasuk Yud Gimel,
yes,
right, it says Hashem says to Abraham, Lamazet tachakas Sarah Limor, what did Sarah laugh and saying, Ha'af umnam eled v'ani zakanti? How can I have a child when I, Sarah, am too old? When in fact, that's not what Sarah said. Sarah said that Abraham was too old.
Yes.
So the point is that when Hashem reports it back to Abraham, he doesn't want to make Abraham feel bad. He says that Sarah said that she was too old.
Well, she does.
I know. Well,
she does,
but she said, when we're talking about being too old, Zakanti, that's Abraham. She's blaming it on Abraham when she says it. Right? So now, we have a general rule in Judaism is that you can't be firmer than God. Right? One second. So you can't be firmer than... So if it says it in the Torah, if God Himself lies, right, we know that that certainly is going to be okay. Okay? And that's what the Gemara comments at Yevamos, the Gemara in Yevamos actually picks up on this. And it says, Tana Debei Rabbi Yishmael, Debei Rabbi Yishmael Tana, we learned the house of Rabbi Yishmael taught, Gadol HaShalom, how great is peace? Sha'af HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shina Bo. Even Hashem changed the truth. That originally, when Sarah said it, she said that Abraham was too old. Ulubasov Ksiv Vani Zakanti. In the end, when he reported it back, it said that Sarah was too old. So what's amazing is that you see that how great Shalom is, that it can be changed. Even Hashem was willing to change it for the sake of Shalom, for the sake of peace.
Yeah,
so that's one exception that you find.
I was going to suggest to you another thought. It says here, now Abraham and Sarah were old. This is Yud-Aleph. And well stricken in age, and it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. So that's a whole different issue too, because it would be very hard for Sarah to accept it if she didn't have her time anymore.
Right, but she blamed Abraham also.
Yeah,
she included Abraham in it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
so there's a beautiful story. There's a beautiful story that just illustrates this point. There was once a girl, a chassan and kala, they got married, and this, you know, the kala, she came into a pretty large family, you know, a lot of siblings, married siblings, and she was like, you know, the newcomer in the marriage. And into the family. And like a week after the wedding, she lost her ring. She lost her engagement ring. And can you imagine the embarrassment that she felt? Like, you know, after a couple of weeks it came out because she was looking for it and, you know, asking, did you see it? You know, she lost her ring. And you can imagine the embarrassment, not only she was upset that she lost her ring, but the embarrassment in front of all her new family members that here she is, she feels like a schlamazel. You know, she gets married, you know, and she loses her engagement ring. Like, what kind of wife is this? And it was a terribly difficult time for her until that Pesach came around and her husband was going through his suits and he found her engagement ring in one of the suits. Okay? So now instead of her looking like the schlamazel, now the husband, you know, he looked pretty bad. So that went on, you know, and then she got her ring back, and it was a big relief for her. It was great, and she felt much better after that. 20 years go by, and the family falls on financial difficulties. You know, by now it's a nice family, Baruch Hashem, and she has to sell her engagement ring. So she goes back to the place where she originally got it, and she said, "Listen, you know, I know you sold it to me 20 years ago. And right now I need to sell it back to you. Can you tell me how much it's worth?" So the man takes the ring and he says, "I never sold you this ring." And she said, "What do you mean? I know you sold it to me. What are you talking about? You know, I have the receipt." He said, "I know I sold you a ring, but I didn't sell you this ring. I know my rings." Turned out that the husband, he bought a new ring for the wife. And He pretended to find it that Pesach and he gave it back to her, but he didn't tell her the whole time. He didn't tell her for 20. Can you imagine? And you know, he took the blame. And for 20 years, you know, can you imagine how much he probably wanted to tell her? You know, I bought that ring. There probably many times that came up where he had the opportunity or the willingness to do it, but he didn't. And that's an example of when you're allowed to lie. You're allowed to not say the truth mipnei hashalom. To bring shalom bias, there's nothing bigger than shalom. So that's one exception. We have shalom, right? You're allowed to lie for shalom for the greater good. There's another example that the Gemara says, which is based on the same concept, that if you're doing it for totally selfless reasons, you're allowed to change the truth. That's the example of in Bab Metzia Chaf Gimel, the Amar Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Bahani Tlas Mili Avidi Rabbanan de Meshanim de Milahu. There's three things that Torah scholars will be willing to change the truth about. B'mesechta, with how much they learn. So if someone asks you, hey, how much Torah do you know? So you don't have to say the truth. You don't have to tell them you know all of Shas. You could just say, you know, I know a few mesechtas. You don't have to say the whole truth. Uve Puria, and in matters of marital relations, you can lie. You don't have to say, you know, when your wife is going to the mikveh, someone asks you, can you give me a ride? You don't have to say, sorry, I can't, because whatever. You can make up an excuse. You could say something else. Uve Ushpiza, right? If there's a house that's very hospitable to people, and a lot of people come over their house, and you're a guest over there, you don't have to tell. If another person asks you, hey, how's the food at that house? You could say, it's okay. Because what's going to happen? The guy's going to get flooded with all these guests. And they're all going to be asking to have a meal by this guy because, you know, they heard the food is good or the hospitality is good. So you can lie. In that case, you could lie. And you could, you don't have to say the truth. Now, it's very careful. You have to be very careful when it comes to these things, come to these exceptions to the rule, that you have to always be careful. The general rule of thumb is there has to be no self-interest in when you change from the truth. You can't be getting anything out of it. It has to be purely an act of giving, an act of chesed. When you're lying, you're doing something for the other person, because it can be very, very, it can be a slippery slope if you start, you know, lying and always justifying it, saying, you know, hey, I'm doing it for peace, I'm doing it for the greater good, I'm doing it for this. So be very careful that it's never, you're not taking an ounce for yourself when you actually change the truth. Okay? There's another story with Rabbi Mordechai Schwab. He moved from England to America in the first half of the 20th century. And his parents were still in England. And he used to, back in those days, it was very difficult to communicate by telephone, and they certainly weren't seeing each other. But they used to write letters to each other. And his children wrote letters to their grandparents. And there was a tragedy that happened in the family. His 10-year-old son passed away. And he knew it would cause tremendous anguish and grief to his parents who were in England. So he didn't know what he should do. And what he decided to do was not to tell them. Okay, not only did Rav Schwab not tell them that their grandson had passed away, he continued to write them letters. So as he was, you know, the child who had died at 10, he continued writing letters when he was 11, 12. He wrote them his whole bar mitzvah speech. He wrote that to his grandparents just not to cause them anguish. They didn't know that their grandson had died until the day that they were nifter. They didn't know. They went to the grave not knowing that. Examples like that's when it's totally an act of giving. When you're changing the truth to give to someone else, not to take at all, that's when there's room to lie. Otherwise, though, obviously you have to stick to the rules.
There's some gratification there as well. You've got to feel your parents' anguish. So, I mean, it's hard. Nothing is by itself.
I guess so, right.
Sometimes if you want to explain something to somebody that's wrong that they're doing, you'll pick it upon yourself. You know, I did this, I can't believe I did it, you know. So it's a sharing of really the issue more than if you can't, you're not independent.
Okay, but in general, the point is the motivation has to be a pure altruistic motivation. You have to make sure that it is. You know, if there's maybe some side benefit to it, tangentially, okay, but, you know, it really has to be motivated by pure motives. The last exception that when you're allowed to not be totally honest is when you're dealing with a shyster, dealing with someone who's not completely honest. Good example of that is that something you find in the Torah, where Yitzchak, he takes love on sheep, and he does pose some shtick, and he gets all these sheep to be in his flock. He kind of tricks them. But there we see that Lavan, Yaakov, he did these things with the poles and the sticks, and he produced all these sheep for himself. So even if you want to say that is honest or it's not honest, but certainly he was allowed to do that because you're dealing with a trickster, a shyster, like Lavan. The case you have in the Gemara is the case in the Nedarim. Last page. So it says, "Nodrim laharogim lucharamim ulamuchsin." You can make a promise or a neder to murderers, to tax collectors, to various people who are trying to take your money unjustifiably. So you had. It used to be. Now I'm not talking about tax collectors. Nowadays I'm talking about back in the day. Where what would happen was the person would buy the right to collect taxes from the king, and the king would get his lump sum of money, and now this tax collector would have the right to just milk everyone in the country out for as much money as he can get his hands on. So for a person like that, you have the right to lie to him and to evade, you know, his tax collecting. So it says the case is as follows: that nodrim laharagim lacharam lamuchsin shehi truma. You can tell him, hey, you know, you can't collect this food here because it's truma. Sorry, afal pishenu truma, even though it's not truma. And you could also say shehin shel beis melech. Yeah, sorry, you can't take this, you know, my property over here because that belongs to the king. Afal pishenu shel beis melech. So even though they don't really belong to the king, you can lie. You could say they really belong to the king. Why? Because the person is trying to take something from you, you know, by a form of dishonesty, so you can fight back. You can fight fire with fire, so to speak, you know, and you can lie back to him. There's an amazing case that came before. It just shows you the brilliance of our Gedolim. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who YU is named after, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was the dayan in Europe in the early 1900s. And the following case came to him. He got a letter from a town, you know, a far-out town in Europe, asking him what seemed to be a very simple question in kashrus, you know, which was basically a beferish ashach. It was, you know, pretty much black and white in the Shulchan Aruch. And he got this letter asking what would be the halacha in that case. So what would you do if you were the rabbi? I don't know, if I were him, I would just scribble back an answer and say, you know, whatever the answer was in the Shulchan Aruch. That's what I wouldn't think twice about it. But he was a lot smarter. So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, he inquired about these people, the author of this letter, like, who are these people? Why are they writing letters? He found out that they were actually a couple of troublemakers in town. And he didn't find out the rest of the details, but he surmised it, and this was in fact true, that the rabbi, the local rav of the town, they didn't like him. They wanted to get rid of him. And they asked the local rav this question, and the rav made a mistake. He paskined that it was usser, when in fact it was really mutter. So they wanted to embarrass this rav publicly. What they did was, in order to embarrass him, they wrote a letter to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, and they asked him this question, and they intended to receive a letter back from Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, telling them that, oh, what do you mean? It's mutter. This is very simple. They wanted to receive that letter, okay? And that way they could show it to all the people around town, saying that here you are, this rabbi, our local rabbi made a mistake, and he doesn't really know his learning. He doesn't know his halacha. Therefore, we should get rid of him. That was their plan. So, what would you do now if you're a Rav Yitzchak Elchanan? So, listen to what he did. He wrote a letter back to them, saying that it's in fact usser, which is incorrect, which is not the halacha. But he wrote back to them saying that the question that you asked me, the halacha is that it's usser. Okay? Now the letter is going to take a few days to arrive. Meanwhile, immediately he sends a telegram to those people saying that it's the letter that I just wrote you was a mistake. Actually, I mean to say that it's mutter, but I just made a mistake on the halacha. So what he did now, the letter that he sent them, well, they couldn't use any evidence against this rabbi because the letter that he sent them made the same mistake as the rabbi made, right? And the telegram that he sent them showed that, you know, that even he could make a mistake like that. So he was able to avert the situation by maybe being a little crooked himself, but he was able to brilliantly avert the entire situation. So so just to sum up, right? We talked about the levels of truth, right? The levels of how detailed and how many layers of truthfulness you can have. The nine levels of sheker, of falsehood, and how we should distance ourselves from them. And then we talked about the exceptions. One exception is for shalom, right? We had the three exceptions in the Gemara, for modesty, for humility, to save yourself from harm, right? Those are all reasons why you're allowed to lie to someone. And also, if you're dealing with someone who's a liar himself, you're also allowed to lie in that case. Those are the exceptions. And I think the underlying theme, the underlying rule of thumb that we should all take is that, you know, we as Jews were representatives of the Torah, and we know that the emes, the seal of God, the Gemara tells us, is emes. That's Chosma Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in His nation, we have an obligation that wherever we are, whether we're in business or out in the world, we always have to be models of we're reflecting Hashem, and we have to be models of honesty. It's Rav Shimon Schwab, who was Mordechai's brother. He once said the thing that's holding back the Mashiach is the fact that in the Webster's dictionary, if you look up the word Jew, so one of the definitions is to cheat someone. It's a verb which means to cheat someone. He says, as long as that is in the dictionary, even though it's probably originated by anti-Semites, but if the fact that that canard is able to stick on us, that itself is withholding the geula. So just one story that I heard that hopefully, you know, we could have more stories like this. There was a man who had a baby, and he was driving his wife, and he was speeding, you know, down the highway, and he came to the toll booth, and he shot right through the toll booth. This is back in the days when they used to have tokens. So he shot right through the toll booth. He was wearing his yarmulke, his beard here, yarmulke there, and he sped right through the toll booth, didn't pay. The next day he came back, and he gave the man two tokens. And so the man behind the toll booth asked him, "What do you have?" He said, "Excuse me?" He says, "I heard you came yesterday, and I know that, and the guys were telling me that anytime people like you come through the toll booth and speed through, you're always going to come back with two the next day. So I know you had a baby. I just want to know, what did you have?" So Mirtz Hashem, Be'ezus Hashem, we should all strive to be model Jews and representatives of the truth and the ultimate emes, which is the Torah, and we should bring the Geula Bekarav B'Yameinu. Yeah. Let me just take a couple of questions.
Bring a bad name, let's say, to a Jew because we're followed. But by the same token, you're saying, wait a minute, if you're dealing with the outside world and that businessman is trying to get over on you, then you can, you know, work around so you get over on him.
Well, if he's trying to harm you, yeah, you can. If he's trying to damage you and harm you, you know, there is probably a lot of gray area which you should, when there's a doubt, perhaps you should take the high road and just be honest.
Well, that's where the Jew.
Right. But if someone is actively, he's trying to steal from you, you know, if a robber comes in and says, "Hey, where's the safe?" You know, you're not going to say, "It's right there." You know, you just. It's in the next guy's house, actually, you know. You know, the point is that if someone's trying to actively harm you, you can do your events to, you know, take precautions against that, take measures against that. Anything else?
Something about very early on, about nine categories of sheker. You talked about something regarding a broad lie and something about public, you said. Do you remember what you said?
Yeah. I hope I remember. Yeah. Yeah. That was talking about the Gemara in Baba Metzia, yeah. Where there's certain things that if you make a promise, if it's kind of like a broad promise where it's not, you weren't so specific and it's, you didn't pin yourself down to it, so you can renege on that promise in certain instances. In cases where the other person wasn't really relying on you. In other words, it's assumed that the person wasn't fully relying on you if, you know, if it was not done in public, or it was done, it was like kind of a big promise, where it's not expected you're necessarily going
to
follow through. If it's done in public, you have to fulfill it. Because the assumption is, if it's done in public, you mean to stick with it. You're not going to just say stuff in public without meaning it.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you for a clarification. When you were talking about the text messaging with the days...
Yes.
That was before you talked about the exceptions for Darkei Shalom.
Yes.
So are we saying that that's actually going to be mutter because of Darkei Shalom, or is that still...
No, I don't think that's Shalom there. I'm just... I'm trying to make them feel good.
Feeling with the Zulat, with the other person, why isn't that... Come under the rubric of Darkei Shalom.
Of making them feel good?
Well, it doesn't... Then it is a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Well, that you could ask the same thing. So then why would you not be allowed to invite someone? Why would you not be allowed to invite someone to your simcha when you don't intend on having him to come? You could ask the same question. Why isn't that fall under the category of Mipnei Darkei Shalom?
I mean, if you do that and he accepts, then you will accept him. That's not...
Well, that's different. If you would actually... It's talking about a case where you know he wouldn't come, and you wouldn't have invited him if you knew he had. If you knew he would. Well, if he accepts and you let him come, then it's okay, because you're willing to take that chance. Then it's okay. That's different. We're talking about a case where for sure he's not coming. There's no way. And you wouldn't... Had you known that he might come, you wouldn't have invited him. So there, you're not allowed to invite him. All right.